The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
In today's episode, hosted by Captain Carl Flynn, he sits down with Major Eric Chaya, and they discuss Major Chaya's career from his time as a platoon leader to his current research at NPS focusing on regenerative agriculture.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everybody listening. As Ash introduced me, I am your host, Carl Flynn, and today we're going to be doing a Below the Surface interview with one of our new podcast hosts, Eric Chaya. We'll start out with just some autobiographical information, so I'm sitting here in front of the course notes. Eric, would you be willing to just go through big bullet points, starting from commissioning up to how you got to where you are here today?
Yeah, first of all, congrats on pronouncing my last name correctly. I don't get that a lot. So yeah, Eric Chaya. I went to Marquette University, commissioned as an infantry officer. Back in 2011, I served as a rifle platoon leader. I was a reconnaissance platoon leader. I was a company XO and then assistant operations officer, all before I went to Special Forces Assessment and Selection. From there, I spent 2 years in the Q course, we call it, the Special Forces Qualification Course. Graduated there around 2018, and I showed up to 3rd Special Forces Group, where I was a team leader, or a Special Forces Operational Detachment Alpha Commander, for about 3 years. And then after that, I was a General's Aide for the USSOC, U.S. Army Special Operations Command Deputy Commanding General, which was probably a really interesting assignment that I can't say I really wanted at the time, but I learned an incredible amount and had a great mentor during that time. But now I'm a defense analysis student pursuing a master's of science degree here at NPS.
One quick question just to satisfy my own curiosity. So going from rifle platoon leader to reconnaissance platoon leader, we did one exercise up at Fort Irwin attached to the 11th ACR. And so just to make sure I have my understanding correct of Army TO, so a reconnaissance platoon, so are those Cav Scouts or is that part of the infantry or what?
Definitely not Cav Scouts. No, I was in a striker brigade.
Okay.
So we were, I mean, our saying in 2nd Infantry Division was, what's the most lethal part of a striker platoon? And it was the 9-man infantry squad. So very much, yes, we had wheels, we had a platform to get us from A to B, but definitely held on to like being infantrymen. But yeah, reconnaissance platoon, I really enjoyed my time as a rifle platoon leader. And I really thought it was like the logical progression was to go to reconnaissance. And then learning that reconnaissance is really difficult. It's the most unglorified and probably most difficult time I had as a platoon leader. Because it's like you either provide the information the commander wants and you just did your job, or didn't and you're terrible. You know, like you send back a spotty report that doesn't have all the information because you're either limited on time or cover, concealment, whatever it is. That's a tough spot to be in, especially as like a young platoon leader, you're directly working for your battalion commander. That was a challenging experience, but I learned a lot too, probably a lot more than I learned being a rifle platoon leader.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So I was, well, not to get too sideways here, but I was in a light armor reconnaissance unit in the Marine Corps, and they are nominally infantry, but similarly, we're in 8-wheeled armored vehicles rolling around. So it's like, wait a minute, what do you mean we're not locating, closing with, and destroying? Like, we have to go find stuff and reconnoiter stuff? Like, what is this? Yeah, interesting.
I eventually went, so I was in an infantry battalion, and then I did the reconnaissance, and then I became Company XO. And our company was an anti-tank company that was in an infantry battalion, and then we got moved to a Cav Scout squadron. And I'm pretty convinced I would have got out of the Army if I hadn't experienced the switch over to the cavalry. I mean, I was pretty frustrated as an infantryman. It's a tough life, but the cavalry had a totally different mentality. I almost think it was such a blessing to go over there. And we can get into this, but I ran into some incredible leaders who really cared about me, my development. Maybe it's just anecdotally, but I didn't experience that necessarily as an infantry PL. I have a lot of love for the Cav Scouts.
Gotcha. Yeah, we were attached to the 11th ACR, and they are a cavalry regiment. Yeah. So, yeah, we had a great time working with them up there. So, second data point, but yeah, very much agree with a lot of love for the Cav Scouts. So, talking about being the aide to the general up at USASOC, and so if memory serves correct in our previous conversation before we started recording, he was actually the one who even made you aware that NPS existed.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, I heard about it. I had a really good company commander who, when I was a team leader, one of the first things he did is he brought in all his captains and he talked about life after team time, which is something none of us want to think about, you know, because we all just did these 2 years of the grueling qualification course and all we want to do is like be on the team and talk about being on the team. And he sat us all down and brought different majors who had gone to the different ILE source. So we had a guy from Fort Leavenworth, you know, he'd done the CGSC, that's like the Army's version of intermediate level education. And then he brought in someone who went to MPS. He did a Georgetown type fellowship that was pretty unique, but he brought in different people. And so I'd heard about MPS and I thought, yeah, that's cool, but that's way up, you know, that's the other side of the country. And I'm pretty happy with North Carolina. We had a house, we had property, you know, we had a little farm thing going on. We were homesteading. So we really liked it. So I kind of ruled it out despite hearing about it then. So I'd heard about it. And then when I became a general's aide, I was talking to him about what am I going to do when I'm done being an aide. And I said, you know, I'm going to go to the National Defense University. They have a campus right here on Fort Bragg. I don't need to leave. 10 months, wham, bam, I can be done. And then I'm right back in third group, which is what I wanted to do. And he said, I think you should consider the Naval Postgraduate School. It's what he had done. He had a great experience. He had a really cool manhunting thesis that we talked about and was really passionate about his time here and the development and relationships he made here. So when students give briefs here, there's often a general officer who listens to what the theses are and kind of the new developments there. So General Marks was asked to take some briefs. So he said, come out, we're going to experience this and let's take some of these briefs. And then when we're not in the briefs, I want you to explore campus. I want you to go over and go drive through La Mesa. I have four kids. And so he's like, La Mesa is incredibly unique. And sure enough, you know, we drove through La Mesa and there's like packs of Disney princesses running around. And I'm like, this is not like my neighborhood back in North Carolina. This would be a good experience for my family. I met a couple professors. We went out to dinner and I thought, okay, this is pretty unique that we get this time to really focus on being a student and to think. And I mean, we talked to, you know, there was Colonel Brinker, there was General Marks. There were a lot of leaders who had done this and really talked fondly about their time here and enjoyed it. So applied and got in.
Fair enough. I will say, having been here for a little while, it does kind of surprise me because I might have been less aware about NPS before I got here than you were. But once I showed up here, I thought, you know, it's the Naval Postgraduate School, figured to be very heavy Navy command. And it is. It's mostly Navy officers, but you look around at an SGL or something where the entire student body is here and it's like, oh, there's a ton of not only different branches, but also even allies and coalition countries that are here too. And then, yeah, in the DA department, a lot of Green Berets, a lot of SEALs, a lot of recon guys, couple of Raiders, not too many. But yeah, I was surprised by how many Green Berets there are, especially now that I know a few folks in the DA department. So it would seem that based on the fact that there are general officers and colonels who've gone to NPS, it's not entirely uncommon.
No. And I mean, they're successful. It's like this school has a good reputation in our community.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so they realize you're going to be gone for a while, but there's friends of mine who applied who didn't get in. It's fairly challenging to get here it's just a paper board. It's not an in-person board, but I would encourage people to apply because it's been a great experience for me and that I haven't heard too many negative things from any of my mentors who have done this as well.
Likewise. Yeah. Later on, I would like to circle back because I think it'd be good to get your perspective and your advice to prospective students. But before we go to that, I would like to talk about your thesis and your research and also your background behind it. Pretty unique. You would not expect, you know, a Green Beret officer to be doing research into farming. But, you know, there are all sorts of theses and they do tie back to national defense. So specifically, you're talking about operating. Well, so first, you'd already mentioned in Lejeune, you had Fort Bragg in North Carolina, you had property and you were homesteading, you had a small farm going on. So could you walk us through that and then lead up into how that ties into your NPS research?
Yeah, this is kind of a long story, but it's now Fort Liberty, not Fort Bragg anymore. And my wife and I were expecting our first child. We had a family friend who had some acreage and they had four children of their own and they were also foster parents as well. And they had about 10 acres and they had chickens and they had pigs and we'd go over there and visit and just the kids were outside. They were running around, they're playing with chickens, they're bringing eggs in. You know, it was different. And I thought, this is kind of what I want for my kids. But we weren't really sure if we were going to be staying. I was in the qualification course at that point, so I didn't have my group assignment yet. So we kind of took a risk and we found some property and we started building before I knew what group I was going to be in. So it was absolutely a risk, but we just felt like that was the right thing to do. And felt like a real piece about buying and staying put. Obviously, I got stationed at Fort Bragg, so it worked out. But I couldn't really explain how I got this really in-depth passion about agriculture. You know, initially we had this property that was just overgrown and hiring dozers and excavators that's really expensive. And so a friend of mine said, you know, why don't you try and use some pigs to do some clearing for you? Because I wanted shooting lanes. I wanted to be able to reach out there and touch things.
Talking my language.
There you go. So we brought in some pigs and we just started putting up some electric netting and moving pigs around to clear out some really brushy and overgrown areas. And they did a really good job. And I think the logical progression was to get chickens after that to kind of get the insect load. And, you know, there's a lot of ticks and chiggers and bugs and stuff like that, spiders that they just go after. So they just walk around your house and patrol. So we're kind of getting into this stuff. And then meanwhile, I'm in third group. And so we're going to Africa and we would see places that are agrarian-based economies where animal husbandry is the chief profession. And it wasn't a hobby like it was for me. And if they didn't do it right, there were some real dire consequences. And so, and we even saw them work with the military. So like the locals, we wanted to play soccer on this field. And they don't have a lawnmower crew to come out. And so we saw essentially kids with sticks who brought in cattle. They moved it across the soccer field and we had like a new soccer field. There was a range we wanted to use that was pretty overgrown. And in Africa, I mean, it was a range. It was just a big open area with rocks.
Yep.
And a berm behind it. And, you know, we said, hey, we want to do some machine gun training with you guys. How would we bring the vegetation down just so we can train, you know, just so we can talk through the basics? And they said, oh, no problem. We'll have it cleared by tomorrow. And there were some fresh cow patties out there, but I mean, it was mowed down. They used these nature-based solutions that was pretty incredible. And so we saw it work really well. It was a symbiotic relationship between the local ranchers, so to speak, you know, the local herdsmen and the military. And then later that night, we'd be, you know, eating steak off the local economy. There's no 18-wheelers bringing in all these supplies. It was absolutely what we could get off the local economy. So I thought, what a really cool way to, you know, we talk, there's all sorts of aspects of civ-mil relations, but I thought around our installations, there's kind of been at the fence line, a separation between the locals and the military. And I thought this could be a really neat way that if we were to provide land access to locals who wanted to implement what we call regenerative agriculture, I'll define that here in a second, but they're implementing these environmental best practices on DOD land. It's incredible what we can do. And the definition that I like to use is from this company called Understanding Ag. It's farming and ranching in synchrony with nature. And so we're focused on restoring, rebuilding, and revitalizing ecosystem functions, starting with all life below the soil and then working our way up. So we're using the cattle as a tool. And so I was actually in class, I was talking to, there's this documentary called Kiss the Ground. So I'm talking to this fellow student of mine. This is first quarter, so I haven't picked out a thesis at this point. And I'm talking to another DA student about this documentary. And I get kind of passionate about it. And I think it's really neat. I think it's an incredible way to farm and ranch, kind of going beyond sustainable. And then again, like using the word regenerative to actually like build up to improve upon what we have right now. And there's a professor, Dr. Nafisi, who kind of hears me at the end of class talking to this other student. And he said, are you talking about your thesis? And I said, no, it's not my thesis. It'd be really cool if this was my thesis. And he said, I really think this should be your thesis. You know, your voice changes, you're passionate about this. I was watching your body language. You know what you're talking about. I absolutely think, you know, the Army has a climate strategy. Have you read it? And I was like, well, not yet.
Good answer.
Yeah. And so I went back and read the Army climate strategy, which, you know, the Army's the first ones developed this climate strategy, and they talk about some net zero goals in there. The Army has 13 million acres of land, and you know, there's a lot in there about electric vehicles. They talk about microgrids, there's renewable energy. And I thought, well, what about this 13 million acres of land? Not every acre of that is suitable for what I'm talking about. There's training areas that this is not going to work, right?
UXO.
Exactly. And I don't want to get in the way of training. I continually go back, like our number one focus on these installations, these bases, is warfighter proficiency, first and foremost, right? But if we have this goal of net zero emissions, let's offset. Let's land managed properly can be an incredible carbon sink. And we have like data that supports healthy soil and what how much carbon we can sequester. Again, you know, we probably won't go into it here, but like carbon is a cycle. And I get that, but there is a great way. It's an incredible way with a giant land mass like the Army has. I mean, the DOD is 26 million, you know, over 26 million. So there's a lot of land out there that we could be using this. And we're starting to see other Marine Corps Air Station Yuma, they have a regenerative grazing project going on. Yeah, they just started it. It's really cool. I mean, they're re-greening the desert. It's amazing. The Department of Energy just did a study out in Wyoming. People are doing this. And I think the Navy is really moving out on this. In fact, she's the senior climate advisor to the Secretary of the Navy. Her name's Deb Loomis. And when I thought this could be a really good idea, this could be a thesis, we could develop this thanks to, you know, Dr. Nafisi's encouragement, got a great advisor with Shannon Houck and Kristen Flesher and Dr. Nussbaum and Energy Academic Group. They said they liked this. It was just incredible how much support I got for something that I thought people were going to kind of say is too out there. But climate goals, yes, we can reach those as well. But then I go back to Africa or even my experience in Afghanistan too, where how important animal husbandry is. So we've got to brief a lot of people. And I know we said we're going to talk about advice for future students later, but my big advice, I am really glad I got a thesis partner. Ian McAlpine's my partner. And that would be another advice. Get someone who's smarter than you. And that was like, I have someone who's way smarter than me. He writes better than I do, better looking than I am. You know, like I would really encourage you to get a thesis partner too, because like someone to bounce all these ideas off of and someone who's organized. I like having this vision and kind of these grandiose goals and going after things. And Ian has been really good at like grounding me and saying, hey, how realistic is all these things? Let's focus this. Let's narrow it. So a thesis partner is really helpful. And I know some people want to just kind of move out on their own schedule. And I thought that's what I wanted to. But once Ian got here and I started talking to him about this thesis, I just really felt that having a partner has been instrumental into how successful we are. You know, we can be two places at once. You know, like the Marine Corps installation commander was here and I couldn't be here, but Ian was here and he briefed him our project. And now we're, you know, potentially looking at implementing this in, you know, maybe Pendleton or it even made its way back to Deb Loomis that the Marine Corps installation commander had heard about this and was interested in it. So again, it's just like the thesis has been a lot of fun. And I think it's because one, I have a unique background. I was doing this type of, you know, moving the cows every single day. And I guess I should talk about what type of grazing we're talking about here. So regenerative agriculture being kind of a big term about how agriculture as a whole, our thesis is really focused on what's called adaptive multi-paddock grazing. So there's quite a few Army installations that are grazing cattle, and there's different ways to graze. You know, people have probably heard about rotational grazing here and there, and this is like way beyond rotational grazing. What the typical grazing operation is, it's a conventional, we call it set stock grazing, where you have, let's say, 1,000 acres, and they're all out there. And they, you know, maybe have a couple water points here and there, but they're out there and what we see is that they go for the best, the most nutritious, you know, just like you and I, if you're given just total free choice between, you know, going for a steak or a salad, depending on your preferences, you're going to go for one probably more often than the other. And so the cattle are the same way. They're going to go out there and essentially they're going to eat down, continually eat down until they kill the really beneficial plants. And then that creates like bare ground. And then we see the quote unquote invasive species. When there's bare ground, what can heal it? As we say, weeds are just scabs. They're trying to heal essentially a management problem we created. So they're not necessarily invading. It's essentially we invited them. We created the conditions for them to thrive. So we see that a lot on installations too. And so when Ian and I were talking about how, you know, we want to write about this, but can we actually go out and do it? And so we thought, let's pilot this. Let's try and get some funding and actually go out and do it. And so MPS and especially DA has a good relationship with DLI and Presidio of Monterey. And the garrison commander over there heard about our presentation. He sat down with me just to kind of give me pointers. He's also a fellow Green Beret, Colonel Sam Klein. And he said, you know, I think this is really cool. I have the principal deputy, assistant secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment, Mr. Paul Farnan, is going to visit Presidio. Would you want to brief him this project? So totally happenstance, right? And just thanks to Colonel Klein for opening the door. And we presented him, here's what regenerative agriculture is, which he was familiar with. So we didn't have to spend a whole lot of time there. But then like, here is adaptive multi-paddock grazing. Here's what Ian and I have seen in other countries and how these agrarian-based economies could really benefit from implementing something like this adaptive multi-paddock grazing. Again, some countries are doing it better than others, but we really think our number one export here in the United States should be knowledge. We have the labs, we have the universities, we have the testing and the funding to test these things. So that's what we should be exporting, not anything else, not chemicals, not commodities, not... That should be what we're promoting.
Gotcha.
And Mr. Farnan said, this is really cool. Can we do this? Essentially, can you do this internationally? And Ian and I said, let's kind of an adage that we use in Special Forces a lot is we're masters of the basics. We get the basics right before we move to the really exquisite capabilities. We are going to master the basics. And that's what we really pride ourselves on. And so Ian and I kind of looked at each other and we said, let's master it here, CONUS, stateside. Let's use an installation and let's do it here. So we've talked to and briefed a lot of different installation commanders and environmental teams. And we've kind of come up with two locations. That is Camp San Luis Obispo, a National Guard base just down the road.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
In SLO, in San Luis Obispo. And the other one's Camp Roberts, 90 minutes south of here. Just so ideal locations for us. But it's just interesting. I mean, we talked to bases in Virginia and Kentucky and Iowa, and it just kind of kept coming back to California, which was great because we're so close. And so he said, so this is back to Mr. Farnan too. And he said, all right, well, I want you to brief Honorable Jacobson. So the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. She should hear this because I really think there's something here. And with both of our blessings, we essentially could get a pilot funded and we could research this and then see if this is something A, we can do throughout the Army. You know, we change how we manage our land, but B, create a model that's exportable.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Incredibly exciting. So she also visited Presidio Monterey. Colonel Klein once again said, hey, we'd love to have you come out, do your presentation. We briefed her. It went incredibly well. And she said, yes, I want to do this. Find some ideal locations, make sure they're environmentally compliant, and we'll fund the project. That's like where we're at. We're really toward the end of this, and we have Camp San Luis Obispo environmentally compliant. We're still working on Camp Roberts, but we're so close to being funded, I can taste it, as I keep saying. But it's like the whole circle of the project, you know, just from kind of having a unique background and doing this, reading about it, doing podcasts about it, even starting this kind of brings me back to a different story where I had the encouragement from Dr. Nafisi, but I also had the encouragement of my wife who said, Eric, you're kind of borderline obsessed about that. You know, you're like, this is, you do so much reading and listening and consuming of all this knowledge. You really should try and put it to use for the Army. And I thought, I'm kind of like doubting it, like, oh, there's no way. So I even start, we have a, for defense analysis, we have a research methods class. You guys have to take a research methods kind of, it's like thesis 101. It's No. Okay. Anyway, we do a research methods class, and it's almost a forcing function to get your thoughts, get your thesis, get your research proposal on paper. You pick your advisor team. And I even started that doing something completely different. So I started doing it completely different. I thought, no, I can't write my thesis about sequestering carbon and regenerative agriculture and this model. And so I go to my advisor, and I'd never been in her office before. I hadn't even picked her as an advisor just yet. I was just sitting down with her to kind of talk about what I had already submitted for my what I thought my thesis was going to be about. And even before I left the house that morning, my wife's like, I really think you should go ahead and talk to her about what you submitted. And she wrote on it, gave me comments.
Oh, so what you submitted was different from...
It was different from my thesis, from what I'm actually doing. Sorry, I'm kind of going back in time, but it just reminded me of this. And I walk in there still doubting whether I'm going to talk about what I submitted or what I really want to write about. And I go into her office, and she's from Montana. And so she has pictures of like rangeland and some cattle up there. And I'm like, okay, there's my sign. This is someone who's going to understand when I talk about cattle. And so the first thing I said is, I know I submitted this. I appreciate your comments and your feedback on it, but I don't want to talk about it anymore. I want to talk about something completely different. I want to talk about grazing management, and I want to talk about how we can create stability in areas of instability through how we implement our grazing. This is Dr. Shannon Houck, and she's like, I want to hear it. Let's go. So that's kind of how it all started. And then, as I mentioned, all the other stuff just kind of followed. I think my other piece of advice would be listen to your wife. You know, she saw this the whole time.
That's phenomenal. That's awesome. Sometimes an external observer has the best perspective. One quick question. So am I correct in understanding that, and sorry, so the specific term, it's multi what?
AMP grazing, adaptive multi-paddock grazing.
Adaptive multi-paddock grazing. Okay. So am I correct in assuming that this was a practice you had already implemented at your house? That specific practice is informing your thesis.
Yes.
Okay. So got it.
The AMP grazing, it's biomimicry. We're emulating the herds of bison and elk using the cattle as essentially a proxy. Our rangelands and grasslands evolved over time with incredible impact from bison, elk, deer, antelope, right? But because we have all these fences up, we really can't do that anymore. So AMP grazing allows us to replicate that as best as possible. So with a single electric wire for work, I would walk out there. My boots would be soaked, or my, you know, shoes, if I'm going in there before we work out, my socks would be all wet. But I would walk out there, construct a little paddock, move them for the day, and they're in there for that day. They're not allowed to go after the most palatable, the most nutritious one, because there's competition, because it's a new paddock every day. So they can't even go back to the old one that they had eaten and try and kill it, because the electric fence, my technology, the electric fence is not allowing them to go back to it.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. We are running a little short on time. So just in the show notes, talked about wanting to talk about obviously your thesis advice. We talked about that, talked about just your autobiographical information, how you got from commissioning to here, and a few major bullet points. And then we didn't talk specifically at any one point about advice to future students, but we kind of interspersed it. So before we close, is there any specific thing that you want to hit and give to our audience before we close for today?
Yeah, I would say if you listen to podcasts, which I'm assuming you do because you're listening to this right now, whatever kind of realm you're into, you know, if you're really into human health and performance, the military cares about that. And write a thesis you're passionate about, because that's absolutely going to come out in the writing and the passion and the effort. I mean, you're going to spend a lot of time doing this. And so I would recommend it be something you're passionate about, something that you really want to invest time in, because you'll see it in the quality of work that you put out. And so, as I mentioned, the other piece being having a good partner, specifically what Ian's writing is good. It's like really good, high quality stuff, because he cared. We both care about this and think this is an incredibly important topic. As I mentioned, we have 4 kids, and I would say we have some incredible faculty here. Like, we really do have some awesome teachers who understand we have competing priorities, and they're really, really understanding. Not that you want to overuse and abuse that, but if there's instances where you can't be at class for here or another, or for one reason or another, or maybe a sick child, or, I mean, I've just found that the teachers are really amenable to alternative options, whether you're just dialing in or you're meeting with them after. I mean, they just get it. They get that this is life. So this has been a really good time for our family to be intentional with our time and maybe things that I'd be like, hey, you know, I gotta go. I gotta go to work. I have to be there for this. And this has been a really cool time where I get to go to a recital or I get to be part of the science fair. You know, maybe not just attending it, but I get to help with the big poster board, whatever. So this has been an awesome time for our family too. So I encourage people to really focus on that as well.
I couldn't agree more. I would also say, just to caveat that, having a big family, it's also a double-edged sword because I have no kids, not married, but my thesis advisor has four kids. So he's like, Carl, what are you doing? I can get all this done and I have four kids. So yeah, but yeah, for having kids. I mean, there's so many students here who have big families. So fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Eric, for joining us. Look forward to hearing episodes that you'll be hosting in the future. Fantastic. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Carl.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room Podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.